I would like to use this Monday to continue with the once-a-month talks I give on the paramis, the perfections. And normally I do it the Monday after the Friday parami class, practice day, but there were other things that I talked about, so now catching up with that today. So there are 10 paramis, 10 perfections. And so in the course of about a year, we're going through all 10, so one Monday a month. And the perfections, or the paramis, paramitas in Sanskrit, some people know that word, are sometimes referred to as forces of purity or forces of character that individuals can have, that can be developed. And not only do they provide a foundation, but they also are understood kind of as a force in a person's life that carries a person or moves a person along. And so they're not just kind of passive things that are available that we can tap into and use, but they are kind of strengths or qualities or impulses or movements or strengths that are actually kind of carrying us along as we go about our practice life. And classically in Theravada Buddhism, it's understood that you need to have a certain amount of these forces of purity, these forces of character, in order to really be able to progress well in the Buddhist spiritual path. And without sufficient number of these qualities, then sometimes people will get stopped in their path. They'll just go so far and they reach a plateau and they don't seem to go any further. So the 10 qualities are, the first one is generosity. The second is virtue. The third is renunciation. The fourth, which is this month, is wisdom. And then the fifth is strength or energy. And the sixth is patience. The seventh is truth. The eighth is resolve or determination. The ninth is loving kindness. And the tenth is equanimity. These are kind of, some of them can be abstractions, and people can have all kinds of views and ideas about these abstract qualities. But in the tradition, these are meant to be something that comes from within us, something we develop and cultivate within us. And regardless how much of them we have, they can be strengthened within us. And part of classical Buddhist practice is to take time and take the effort to develop these different qualities. 10 is a big number, so maybe you do one at a time over a long period of time. But you kind of do the work that develops these qualities so they can be of service to do the really deep work of liberation and cultivating compassion. Now, they're very interesting, these paramis. They're understood to be the foundation or the background or the supports for spiritual practice. But generosity by itself, or any of these qualities by itself, in the way we normally understand it, is not a parami, not a perfection. What makes it a perfection is when these are connected to two things. One is liberation, freedom, awakening. And the second is it's connected to compassion, our compassionate response to the suffering of others. And both those things have to be present. So a generous act that is a parami is one where the act itself, or the impulse to generosity, is liberating for the person who's being generous. Somehow moves a person in that direction of freedom. So you wouldn't practice generosity as a burden then, or as an obligation, or as a duty, or something that you're kind of reluctant to do. In order for it to be a perfection that kind of moves us along the path, it has to have some quality of liberating us, of freeing us, so it has some benefit for the giver. But also there has to be connected to compassion. So if we're giving to someone, we have to understand it's not just giving, again, out of obligation or it does us good, but we understand that it really helps the other person in along their path, along their way. What I find very beautiful about this system is that benefiting oneself and benefiting the other are closely tied together. So much so, you can almost say at times that the two are kind of two sides of the same coin, that both exist together. And so spiritual practice in the Buddhist point of view, and traditional Theravada practice, is not meant to be something that's only selfish, only self-centered, and practices for me and my own well-being. But it's also not only about other people and their well-being. But it's a wonderful combination of both, and they both work together. kind of a symbiotic relationship. They both support each other, strengthen each other, and both go hand in hand. Benefiting self, we benefit others, and benefiting others, we benefit the self. So today the topic is wisdom. And wisdom is a great abstract word. It's so abstract that I kind of don't like to use it too much. It's kind of a state, like the state or the domain, the state of being wise. And wise partly implies kind of knowing, knowledge, being judicious, being able to discerning about what's going on. But sometimes when we use the word wisdom, I have this feeling that myself, and maybe sometimes other people, associated with having certain knowledge. Like you have some wise knowledge, you learn something really wise from someone, and you carry that wisdom with you. And it's kind of acquired, something you carry with you. And the Buddhist idea of wisdom, prajna in Sanskrit, or panya in Pali, is much more than something you acquire from a book or from a teacher or from life experience. Something that you can carry with you as a knowledge or piece of information that you can apply in different situations. Because I associate wisdom with that kind of situation, it's kind of abstract. I like to explain wisdom as being four, that there's four different aspects of wisdom, and then use these four different words to describe these four aspects. Now, in talking about these, one of these four aspects, one of the things we need to understand about the Buddhist idea of wisdom is that it involves some kind of subjective change. It's a kind of it's partly a relationship to ourselves subjectively, and partly the way we subjectively are in relationship to the world around us. So having some understanding of oneself as a subject and how we experience the world and how we're transformed and changed is a very important part of negotiating and finding wisdom. And along this line, the tradition says that, or the Buddha said, that there is no wisdom without concentration, and no concentration without wisdom. So in order to develop wisdom in the tradition, there has to also be a simultaneous development of the ability to be concentrated or focused or a stability or calmness in the mind or the heart. So again, it isn't just simply some acquiring of knowledge, but wisdom itself involves some kind of change that we go through, some transformation that we go through in order for the wisdom to arise through us and out of us. So developing concentration is understood as one of the important precursors or supports or doorways into developing concentration. So that's one of the reasons why meditation is very important, because meditation is one of the places where we develop calm, stability of mind, so we can see clearly. The analogy that's given is that if you want to look into through the surface of a pond, and the wind is blowing and the pond is agitated, you can't see through into the bottom, or the pond won't reflect, you know, what's the forest around it. But if the pond gets really still, then you can see through the surface, or the surface will reflect what's around it. So same thing with the mind. If the mind gets still or calm and is no longer agitated, the mind can see much more clearly. You can see to the bottom of the mind, and the mind will reflect much more accurately the world around it. Developing that calm and concentration is a really important part of the Buddhist spiritual endeavor or path. So there are four different aspects to wisdom. And one of them is, in fact, understanding or knowledge. So that's also, even though it's only part of what it is, it does have a place. And that can indeed come from books or from Dharma talks or from, you know, different sources where we learn about, for example, the Buddha's teachings. It's considered very helpful to do a certain amount of study, a certain amount of reflection on what the Buddha had to teach or what different teachers might say, to reflect on it in some deep way. Not just to kind of take it superficially or take it for granted or just believe it or don't believe it, but actually engage in the teachings in some very active way. Have discussions about it with friends or with teachers. Challenge each other, challenge teachers. You know, I don't get challenged anywhere nearly enough here at IMC. I don't know why that is, but you guys are just, you know, haven't been doing your job very well. So to challenge, so we can be kind of in the challenge, all kinds of things are clarified, and we find out what's going on, to kind of go deeper in what's going on. But to do the whole realm of called reflective thinking about the experience, of understanding, so it's more cognitive, the cognitive side of understanding, the tradition says that certain kinds of understandings, certain kind of perspectives, when adopted and used, are very helpful for finding the path and engaging the practice. One of the things that's considered very helpful, the perspective to have, that gives a certain level of confidence for finding the spiritual path or engaging in it, is to have confidence that our actions make a difference. And this is what the teaching of karma is about, is pointing that our actions make a difference. Our physical, verbal, and mental actions make a difference. If we want to learn a musical instrument, and we want to practice and practice and practice, we're probably not going to undertake the musical instrument training unless we had some confidence that our actions of training are going to make a difference. In fact, we'll learn the skill over time. A lot of human endeavors, very ordinary ones, take for granted that our actions make a difference, and so we train ourselves or we develop ourselves in certain ways. So the Buddhist spiritual life is the same thing. To have confidence or to understand that our actions make a difference and how they make a difference is a very important part for having the confidence in the path, and the confidence in ourselves, and finding what we need to do. Our behavior makes a difference. The degree of our ethical behavior, ethical activity, our behavior, our activities of generosity, of kindness, of compassion, they all make a difference. They're planting seeds or creating conditions. They're conditioning us in such a way that disposing us to enter into the path in a helpful way. So that's one of the understandings the Buddhist tradition says it's really helpful to have. Some people don't believe this is the case. Then what the Buddhists say is, you don't have to believe it. Why don't you just act as if it's true for a while? Why don't you act as if it's true that your actions make a difference? And then see if you can start acting in certain ways that are considered beneficial. So understanding that being ethical is beneficial and seeing how that makes you more sensitive, how it's brings more peace and calm to your life and clarifies your relationships, for example. Another piece of understanding that tradition says is very helpful to have is some appreciation of impermanence. And you'll find Buddhist teachers giving talk after talk about impermanence, change, transiency, reflecting and seeing things as if they're impermanent, that they're here now and then they're going to go away. They come and they go. And I find this very, very helpful in my life. Because there's a little kind of twist, little kind of, I don't know what it is, there's probably a gene in there, the delusion gene, because it seems so automatic, where even against my best understanding, my mind operates as if what's happening now is going to be this way always. And sometimes it's to my favor, because sometimes I'm kind of optimistic. This is great. You know, it's always going to be so great. But sometimes if things are kind of not going well, oh no, I'm always going to be depressed. Or, you know, my children are always going to be this way. So it's kind of the permanent, you know, permanence gene, or, you know, permanence kind of little bias. Oh, this is it. And it's so helpful to remember that I've gone through these things before and they come and they go. The children go through phases. We're having one of those days today, and probably tomorrow will be a different day. It doesn't have to be, you don't have to make big lifelong plans based on the kids' behavior right now. And the same thing, you know, in all kinds of situations, to understand the impermanence of it, that it's change. In Theravadan countries in Southeast Asia, it's really built into almost the cultural matrix, cultural view of life, the idea of impermanence. And what it tends to do is to make people lighter, rather than heavier and feeling kind of, oh, things, you know, things are impermanent, they're not going to be here. And we might as well not try, or it doesn't make people, you know, kind of serious or morbid or something. Rather, impermanence tends to make people lighter. They kind of go through life a little bit lighter. So that when something happens, like they go out and find their car has a flat tire, one of their first thoughts is, oh yeah, of course. Tires are impermanent. Inflated tires are impermanent. Of course, there it is. In all kinds of situations, say, oh, there's that teaching. That's what I was told. That's what I was expect. Things are impermanent. And so there's a kind of a lightness that, oh, this is what they expect. And then they take care of it. They do the best they can, take care of things. But this teaching of impermanence is said to be very, very helpful, to kind of look at things through that perspective or remind yourself that things are impermanent. There's a lot of other kind of understandings, but a third understanding that tradition says is very helpful to carry with you as a perspective, how to look at your life, an orientation for understanding your life, is what I talked about last week, the Four Noble Truths. The emphasis on the Four Noble Truths is one that says there's so much to understand in human life. Human life is immensely complex. And spiritual life and spiritual books and spiritual teachings are so vast and multifarious. One person can't really understand it all. Let alone, sometimes in the complexity of it all, it's kind of hard to find, where am I supposed to go next? What am I supposed to do? Where's the spiritual life? What's the most helpful book to read? Should I read quantum physics? Or should I read, the history of the English language? Or should I read philosophy? Or should I read car mechanics? Or should I read, what should I read? What's really helpful to read to kind of go forward here with my life? What the Buddha said is that one way to make it very simple is to find what is most essential to know. Or is it, if you can find what's most essential to know, that makes it a lot simpler. And the simplest, most essential formulation of what we need to know is in the Four Noble Truths. That all of Buddhism, or the whole path to liberation, is found within this very simple formulation called the Four Noble Truths. And the Four Noble Truths are not meant to be beliefs, but they're meant to be kind of understandings or orientations or frameworks, perspectives, with which we begin seeing our life. So the first one, for example, is seeing suffering. If you're suffering, it's a lot easier to figure out what to do and where the path is, spiritual path is, if you can honestly recognize that you're suffering. If you put blinders on and don't see it, that's not very helpful. So to turn directly at it and really see it for what it is. And that investigation of it is also needed to see how there might be clinging, grasping, attachment that seems to have brought about that suffering. And then from having seen those two, to see the very simple movement, the possibility at least, of letting go of that clinging and experiencing the peace or the freedom, the happiness that comes when we let go of clinging. So that, in a very nutshell, is the orientation of the Four Noble Truths. So understanding is very important. And some of the places from getting understanding is books. And you're encouraged to read within reason. Some people are nightstand Buddhists, and they just do a lot of reading. And that's really good. It'll be okay. It's better than a lot of other things you could do. But I'd like to recommend one way of reading that I found very helpful for me. And that is to read something every day. Read some Buddhist text or some spiritual book that inspires you every day. But maybe only read one page. And then maybe read it maybe two or three or four times during that day, rather than kind of rushing through the book so you can get to the next book. And if you really take a good Buddhist book, or even a mediocre one, and take one page and then reflect on it, think about it, practice with it, explore how it applies in your daily life, talk to friends about it, you'll be busy all day. There's enough teaching in one page to go a long distance. And you're much better kind of taking it in a kind of serious way, kind of engaged way, one page, than you are kind of trying to rush through everything and say, oh yeah, that's great, I understand that, that's important, that's inspiring, that's great. And it all kind of goes in a kind of superficial way. But just take one page and really kind of let it work your life and explore it. I found it very helpful. There was a period of time when I was practicing a lot where I would sit down to read. I did it kind of formally because I had kind of sat down in meditation posture and I had a table there and I would read my book, read my page. And I'd finish the page or so, and it was like almost too much, just a page. A page of teaching was too much. How am I going to deal with all that? So, you might think about studying in that way, one page at a time, one page a day. So that's the first aspect of wisdom, is understanding. There is a place for understanding. A second aspect of wisdom is can be called insight. We're the Insight Meditation Center. And this is the non-cognitive side of practice, which means that it doesn't rely on understanding or ideas or concepts, but is actually that capacity of the mind to see through the concepts. See through concepts means to see what's on the other side of concepts, but also to see the nature of concepts themselves, to see the nature of thought, to see the ephemeral nature, to see the empty quality of it, or to see the conditioned aspect of thinking, of concepts and ideas, to see how a concept arises and how it passes away. About a week ago, I did an exercise in a workshop here. And the exercise had to do with kind of diversity training, diversity sensitivity. In the group, we divided into groups of two. And then we had to answer three questions, kind of in dyad. And we took turns with the questions. The first question was, talk for a few minutes about experiences you've had of being discriminated against. Some people have had a lot, some people maybe not so much, but talk about experiences you've had of being the recipient of some kind of discrimination, racial discrimination, gender discrimination, some kind of discrimination. Then the second question was, talk about how you have discriminated against others. And then the third question, I don't remember. Remember, Mick, what it was, the third question we did? Anyway, doesn't matter that much. And we had these great questions, three great questions. So we did this in the dyad. And then the instructor said, now, two pairs of people join and form a group of four. And when you form a group of four, each group kind of talked a little bit to the other group of what happened in your discussion of these topics. So kind of make a report or something, talk about what happened. And as soon as that was the instruction, what I noticed was that what had been created, what was being created at that moment, out of thin air, was an idea of me and my partner were a unit, we're a group. We were like, you know, a group. We were like, we're a tribe, like an identity. We were like our own little, right? And now someone else was kind of coming, who was not part of our group, was joining our group. And we had to relate to them. And I could feel a little bit, well, you know, I don't know. And what was really fun, was really, I think, very profound, was to see the arising of that sense of identity, of this creation of a group. This is who I am. And to see how, you know, it was somewhat arbitrary. I could have done the exercise with another person. I knew that, you know, within a few minutes we'd all break up and that identity would disappear. And probably within a couple of weeks I'd probably forget who my partner was. But for that moment I could see that identity being created, being woven out of thin air in a sense. And it only existed in this ephemeral world of my thoughts and my concepts as long as my thoughts and concepts held them in place. And I felt very lucky to have seen it. Because in many situations in life, we live by those kinds of concepts, but we didn't see when they arose, and we don't see how we hold them in place. We don't see how ephemeral or empty they are. And it's really important to be able to do that. So part of the insight work is to be able to see through the concepts, to see their nature, to see what they are. And it's a lot easier to be free of them when we see how they are that way. All kinds of thoughts we have, all kinds of concepts and ideas we have about ourselves, the world around us, other people, what we think needs to happen in our life. So many different concepts we've inherited or developed over our life that we can kind of pull the rug from under or see their arbitrariness or see their usefulness, kind of begin having a wiser relationship to them. The other aspect of this insight work is also to see on the other side of the concepts and to realize that there are other things going on besides our interpretation of different events. And this is a really important part of our particular meditation practice, is to learn to distinguish between what is happening and our interpretation of it. And then the insight work of the kind of deep insight work of our tradition is this non-cognitive seeing. We like to use the word seeing in the tradition because seeing is not thinking. Seeing, having a direct observation or perception of kind of the sensory or the elemental building blocks from which we create a sense of self, from which we create a sense of the world, a sense of relationship to self and other. To see those building blocks, underlying structure, or the process by which we come into being and the world comes into being. So the mind has to be very concentrated or very strong in order to be able to be still enough to see through or see the other side of concepts. Some people find it very refreshing to begin having experience of life that is not so strongly mediated by their concepts and ideas. And this is a very key part of what wisdom is, to have that kind of development of insight. The third aspect of wisdom is what can be called discernment. And I know some translators will translate the Pali word panya by the English word discernment. And part of what's beautiful about discernment is that the word discerning or discernment implies an activity that we're doing. We engage our discernment to understand what's going on, to be discerning. Some people will call it prajna, liberating discrimination. Or I know one translation, appreciative discrimination. They like the word discrimination because it has to do with discerning or discriminating or distinguishing one thing from another. And then using that ability to distinguish, using our intelligence, to begin looking more carefully what's there and distinguishing, making distinctions. And then making those distinctions, seeing what's there and making distinctions. Wise distinction and what's there. And then being able to choose, based on those distinctions, how to follow a path of liberation and compassion. So if I'm sitting meditating and I'm able to see much more clearly what's going on, and I can see that if I start thinking about tomorrow and what I need to do, that's a very different activity than letting go of that and following my breath. It's a very, very simple distinction. Making that distinction, it has a different, you know, our actions have a result, and thinking about the future and planning has a very different effect on me than following my breath. I have a choice here. I'm going to choose to follow my breath. But in following my breath, there are distinctions to be made. I think it's more useful to follow my breath maybe in my belly because it's more comfortable there than following it in my chest. So I can feel the distinction between following the breath in my belly and my chest. That distinction is a valid distinction. It's very direct and immediate. And based on the distinction, I can make a choice about where it's helpful to follow my breath. So I followed my belly. And then I'm paying attention. I notice that there's a difference, different ways in which I apply my attention on my belly. I can be really tight and really focused and really try really hard, kind of bear down to keep my attention there. Or I can have kind of a very light touch and kind of drift away. Or I could kind of just be there in a committed way, firm way, but it's not really pushing or it's not really kind of lackadaisical about it. So making those distinctions, then I say, oh, what is wise? What is useful? Well, I think what's useful is to make this firm, committed effort, not too hard, not too light. So there's this kind of monitoring oneself, seeing distinctions, seeing different experiences, what happens, and then making choices. That ability to be discerning and making choices is a really important part of the wisdom aspect of Buddhism. It's using our intelligence. Now, what I've noticed is that the way Buddhist teachings sometimes get conveyed to Westerners, or the way Westerners hear them, it sounds as if that you're not supposed to use your intelligence when you meditate, when you practice. It's supposed to be kind of like you're supposed to have a blank mind, you're supposed to just trust the Tao, it's supposed to move through you, and you're supposed to kind of get out of the way, and you're supposed to just kind of, not try or not make any effort and just be one with something and it's just supposed to happen. I don't know. I hear a lot, in different kind of language, different understandings, I hear a lot of people have this assumption that they're not supposed to make any efforts to be discerning, to use their intelligence in meditation. My feeling is that you're supposed to use all the intelligence that's available for you when you meditate. You're not supposed to be passive in that kind of way. But you use your intelligence not in a way that agitates you, but you use your intelligence, your discerning ability, to help you find the way to become peaceful, calm, still. If being discerning agitates you, then be discerning enough to know that that doesn't work. And stop doing whatever you're doing, if it's agitating you. Maybe you need to be passive for a while and not do anything for a while until you get settled. And then once you're really calm and settled, maybe you can bring in a quality of discernment to help you find the way. But you use your discernment to help you become less agitated and more concentrated and still. The fourth aspect of wisdom is the mind which does not cling. The mind of liberation, the mind which is free, is described as a mind that is wise. So again, here, it's not a mind that understands anything particularly out there. It's not even a mind that's making distinctions here or having insight, but it's something having to do with the quality of the mind itself. When the mind is not burdened by preoccupations, by fear, by resistance, defensiveness, by ambition, by desire, but the mind is at peace on itself, resting in itself, not needing to defend itself, not needing to build itself up in any way. Just kind of, some people like to use the word having kind of a healthy kind of vulnerability, just kind of openness to experience. But when the mind is at peace in itself and is no longer clinging, that is understood to be a wise mind. The perfection of wisdom, when wisdom gets completely perfected, it's synonymous with a mind that doesn't cling to concepts or to anything at all. So four aspects of wisdom: develop understanding, develop insight, develop the ability for discernment, and a mind that's developed to the point of not clinging to what's happening. The first three aspects of wisdom are helping us find the fourth. The mind that doesn't cling, or the heart, and the mind, heart can be interchangeable, those words, for the Pali word citta. The heart, the mind that doesn't cling, is also seen as a mind which will express its natural compassion. It's kind of like, clinging is like the crust that inhibits the mind's capacity for love or compassion. And when that crust dissolves, then the mind's ability to love or to have compassion is what is partly just maybe all that's left, or one of the things that's left. So here again we see the coming together of wisdom and compassion. The mind that doesn't cling is defined as wisdom, but the mind that doesn't cling is also one that's compassionate. So you see the both going together. If there isn't an increase in compassion as a person becomes liberated, perhaps it's not really liberation. Perhaps it's just simply relief or kind of aloofness, or kind of holding oneself at distance from our experience and finding some peace in doing that, rather than being at peace and allowing us to really feel others and the experiences of the world. As a force of purity or a force of character, wisdom is something that can develop and grow. And all of us have the capacity of becoming wiser, of developing all these aspects. For me, I've understood it to be wisest to think of it developing very slowly. Sometimes it seems to kind of pick up speed a little bit, make little bigger steps. But I think I've been very content and kind of just to realize it happens really slowly. Slowly, slowly, slowly. And it'd be very easy to be discouraged by how slow it happens, because we're often in a hurry. But it actually happens very quickly if you keep it up. If you have a bucket under a faucet and water is dropping into it, it seems like one water is not going to make much difference. But eventually the bucket fills up. Something I said to someone today, I said, we were making plans for something that might happen maybe in 5 years. And I said, it's a little bit discouraging when I think it's going to take us 5 years before this thing can happen. It seems so far away. But if I think back 5 years, that was just like that. That was like a snap of a finger. So I think let's just plan for this thing, because when 5 years comes, it'll seem like it was no time at all, even though it seems so far in the future now. So it kind of, you know, I don't know if that was a good analogy or a good thing, but small steps done over a long period of time can make a huge difference down the line. With dripping drops of water, the bucket is filled. Making small steps towards developing wisdom, insight, discernment, understanding. If you do it every day, cultivate that ability, maybe imperceptibly, day after day, your bucket will be filled. And your heart will be filled until the heart is so filled that the Buddhist tradition will say that it's empty, even though it's full. So, those are my thoughts about wisdom. We have a couple of minutes. Anybody want to ask any questions or have any comments? Ask for clarification? Yes, please.
The compassion or the non-clinging heart. Is there a term or a concept for something that is not a positive statement rather than non-clinging? Is there another meaning to that? Non-clinging is something that is not. Well, is there something that it is?
So it's an absence of something.
Yes.
Sometimes happiness is, or peace is used as a description of that heart. Sometimes as compassionate is also a description of it. The tendency in the early Buddhist tradition is not to offer a lot of positive descriptions of what it is, but describe it by what's absent, and then being confident that what remains is good enough. The part of the reason for that, when there's a positive description, positive descriptions tend to kind of miss the mark. The language can't quite talk about what the liberated state is like. And so if you try to make a positive description of it, people then get attached to that description. That's the way it's supposed to look like. And so by having a negative description, it kind of makes it a little bit harder to get attached to some idea of what it's supposed to be like. That's one thing. The other is that maybe the way it is, what it's like, varies in different situations and different people, for different people. So for example, two people could be in jail, in prison, and maybe they both get liberated from prison the same day, and they go off to live their life. And their experience of being liberated is the same in the sense that what's absent is prison. But how they experience their life as they go away from prison will be very different depending on the choices they make as they go about. So their liberated life could be described very differently. But what's absent in both their life is the bars. So perhaps it's that way also in the spiritual life, that maybe the positive description really depends a little bit on the individual and what goes on in a person's life and experiences and practices they do. And it might vary. And so we want to make some room for the varied ways in which liberation is experienced. There's a wide kind of kaleidoscope of spiritual states. And maybe in different situations, different ones kind of predominate. But all liberated states share in what's missing. That there has to be this freedom from clinging. What do you think of that answer?
I'll think about it.
You think about it before you come back and challenge me some more? Yes.
I'm not quite sure that I have the difference clear between understanding and discernment. Mm-hmm. So if you could just kind of...
Understanding is knowledge. It's having certain concepts, certain understandings that we kind of use to interpret our experience or understand our experience, and based on our past experience or something. So, you know, for example, we understand the role of karma in our life, and so we make decisions based on that. It has to do with understanding we carry with us, some bigger picture, having a picture of what's going on. A discernment has to do with, once we have the ability to have insight, to see clearly what is, kind of not so influenced by our interpretations of what is, then we can start making distinctions between, you know, different situations or different qualities or different directions we might go. So discernment doesn't so much belong. Understanding might come and play a part of that, might influence the discernment, but discernment itself is not centered on understanding so much. It's centered on the ability to see clearly, and in seeing clearly, starting to make distinctions. And see patterns and see conditionality. see that, for example, that when I do X, then Y follows. Okay, maybe that's a distinction. That's a seeing a pattern. And then being able to see that pattern and say, okay, if I don't want Y, then maybe I should let go of X.
Okay, so then can we understand it as a prerequisite for discernment is first comes understanding, and from there because you mentioned also that it implies activity. So from there you go on to take it further.
I think so. I think that in terms of finding the path, using discernment to find the path, some understanding comes into play that helps guide that discernment. But I don't think of discernment as being just concepts and ideas. But understanding has some role. And what that role is varies from person to person, or from philosophy, from different. Some people prefer to have very little understanding, let go of it all, and keep it very, very simple in the practice. And some people have bigger understandings they carry with them that guides that discernment. And that's a kind of personal choice or a different style different people have. Does that make sense? So, last one.
For me, the line between discernment and judging is a difficult one. I keep slipping over to the other side, particularly when it comes to self-judging.
So you are being discerning.
Discerning. But I see that.
Discerning between those two. That's a good beginning.
Yeah, but I wonder if you have any words about how to steer clear of that tendency.
Well, judging usually implies some kind of attachment. And discernment doesn't have any attachment as part of it, some kind of clinging. So one way to be free of it is to then begin to smell your way, or smell out, kind of search out, where's the clinging here? What am I attached to? And that might take many different forms. It might may take the form of being afraid. Sometimes people who are very judgmental, the fuel for that judging is actually some kind of fear or desire to be self-protection. So you might look at, when you're judging, what is the function of the judging? What are you trying to do by judging? It has a function. You're trying to do something. And it's very common the person's trying to protect themselves. That's what's really going on. But might not be other things also. So you might look, what is it? When I'm judging, why am I trying to do that? What function does it have? And as you clarify what it is, then it might be easier to let go of it and not participate in it so much. Okay? So, may you all be wise. Thank you.